irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. My guest is Chelsea Clark, and we're going to talk a little bit about her background. She has a company called GuitarsAndCaffeine.com, and she does all sorts of stuff, a lot of renovation and restoration of guitars, but mods, adjustments, everything. And she has an interesting background. I was introduced to her by Lonnie Spector. He had posted something about her on his Facebook page, and it led to mentioned that she does a lot of YouTube videos on how to on different things. So I was checking it out, and it's like, this is cool. I got to have her on the show. So. That's enough of that. Welcome, Chelsea. It's really a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
And let's also, too, there's some other people in here. My very good friend that I've known for many, many years, Dave Macias, is here. And Suni is here, too. They're playing with we're also on Instagram Live, so she's playing. That's what you're hearing is the camera. So, but anyway, I just want to welcome everybody here. It's great. We have some guitars here, and we're going to talk about some of the repairs. There's a couple things I want to talk to, and also we will get into mojoification.
Remojoification, absolutely.
Remojoification.
Yeah.
So anyway, tell us a little bit about your background, because it's a very interesting background.
It is.
How you got into working on guitars.
You're
good. Take that
awesome.
Off now.
Awesome, I'm going to take this. So I came about it in a very honest way. I was 18 years old and just came back from my first year of college and realized that college wasn't for me and was picking up odds and ends jobs around the town that I was from, which is Athens, Ohio, and got this job hanging cabinets for a guy named Dan Erlewine. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a handful of you out there know who Dan is. If you don't, Dan is a really amazing builder and repairer who, since the 80s, has shared kind of trade secrets, quote unquote. He's the tech face of a company called Stuart McDonald, which is a luthier supply company. Just a really amazing thinker and a great guy. And so when I was hanging cabinets and turning this coal room in his basement into a spray booth, he saw something in me and offered me a job sweeping up shop. I think I had approached him halfway through the job with a broken guitar that I had bought when I was 16 and never learned how to play because some guy borrowed it and broke it before I could ever strum a chord. and so I brought it to him because I saw every day going through his shop that there was guitars. And I said, you want to trade some hours to fix this? Because I know it can be fixed. It's just wood, you know.
What kind of guitar was it?
It was a $90 Fender acoustic guitar that came with, you know, chord book and a tuner. And
was it a bolt-on neck?
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't one of those.
It wasn't a bolt-on neck. It was just some really, I mean, I think they still, you could probably find one in Costco, same deal. You know what I mean? Still. Mm-hmm. So I never had a chance to fall in love with that guitar. But I will say that the day came where it was time to pay me, and I walked into the shop, and he had a bench cleared off for me and my broken guitar, and the check worth the money that I was supposed to get for the job I did. And he said, okay, fix your guitar. I'm going to be over here working on something else. If you have questions, ask me. And that was it. So the first repair I ever did was a broken headstock. And after I set it, he showed me how to kind of reshape the headstock and the wrist of the headstock. And we painted a stinger on the back, a blue stinger. I thought that was so exciting. I got to choose the color and that kind of, that hooked me, I think. I spent years afterwards sweeping up shop and putting away tools just to have another taste of, you know, of fixing something and making it work. Yeah.
Yeah, no, if I'm correct, I looked up Dan because I had heard of his name. I know he was mentioned in Guitar Player magazine years ago. But I think he worked on Dylan's guitars, or he's worked on some pretty famous people.
Big names. He did the Black Walnut Flying V for Albert King. He did a handful for Jerry Garcia.
Yeah, that's
and,
right, Jerry.
Yeah, Hill. And he's had, if you look him up, he's had one hell of a life, just with people he knew and who he grew up around. Iggy Pop was in his band growing up.
Oh, wow.
He was like this young punk kid, and they were in the, what was his band? The Movers, the Prime Movers. I think that was the band name, but yeah, he's had a tremendous life, and always seemed to have led it with a positive, passionate energy about. I want to say about creating, or he's always held thinking and helping others think in a very high regard.
Mm-hmm. He's a good teacher then, because he made you think. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There was never a time that he told me to stop asking questions.
Yeah, that's the real, real teachers.
Yeah,
they want you to ask.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So how did you end up working at Gibson Restoration?
Oh,
which is interesting.
Yeah.
Well, continue.
No,
I'll let you continue.
No, really. That's, okay. So we're fast forwarding. I found myself in New York City cutting hair for a little while. And then I discovered myself at Gibson. No, I had, I actually, when I was in New York, I wanted to be out of New York. It wasn't my city. So I applied to work for Actors Theater, building props in Louisville, Kentucky, and got that position. And while I was there, I met a handful of musicians, one of them being my better half right now, and totally blessed that he's in my life and sitting right beside me. I realized, being a part of a musical community, that I wanted to go back into working on guitars, because it had been maybe 2 years since I had really done that or even thought that it was possible for me to do that. Part-time. So we were in a music store one day called Willis Music, and they had recognized me from the articles I did through Guitar Player Magazine with Dan, called the Mod Squad, and those started back in 2005. And they offered me a job. They said, pardon me, they said that the current person that was repairing guitars, they were having a hard time kind of with the heavy lifting, what we call in the industry is neck resets, and and it was just getting too busy, so they needed to bring somebody else in. So they brought me in, and that was the first time in my life that I ever realized that I could repair guitars for a living. That was the first opportunity I had had to be taken seriously by my surrounding peers. And not that in Dan's shop I wasn't treated like that. It was just outside of the shop doors, it was kind of a joke, right? I was a young female. I was early 20s, cute, and it just seemed to be more of a passing conversation or a look at me kind of statement than actually being taken seriously. So when Willis Music hired me, I got really into it. And I wanted to figure out how to get better. And so I ended up managing both of their locations in the repair shop in Louisville. And then I was talking to Dan one day. And I said, Dan, I got to do something else. I got to do more. I got to learn more. It's just me. And I got enough work, but this isn't enough. You know, I'm setting up Floyd Roses, which is fine, but I wanted something. I was craving knowledge and experience. And so he had just gotten off the phone with Todd Money, who is an amazing guy who runs an amazing team at Gibson's Restoration Shop. And so they were looking for a person to come onto their team. At the time, I think it was a team of 9.
I mean, I knew of the custom shop, but I never heard of the restoration.
The restoration shop. They're badasses.
Now, let me ask
they do all the modifications for the artists.
Let me interrupt real quick. Yeah. When you met Suni, did you start working on his guitars?
You know what? I didn't. I think it was like this whole thing of, don't mix, was it they call business with pleasure or something like I didn't want to set up his guitar in a way that that just wasn't, I don't know, you know what, it
wasn't, that's interesting.
It wasn't until very later on and he's a very interesting kind of customer too, because he, as a player and as a collector, he doesn't like to modify so much, right? So he's not a tinkerer, and he's such a badass with guitar that it's very rare that he says, oh, this guitar is unplayable. So it never came up until a year or two ago.
Suni will hate me because I was telling you before the show, almost every guitar I've had is modified.
Sure.
But they weren't working. I mean, as a studio musician, I had to get them to get to a certain point.
Absolutely. And I don't think you're against that. I think it's just not you. He's always had this
idea. No, he just found a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, they got to be well modified. I don't know.
So anyway, back to the restoration. So this was how long is this? That department, was that there for years and years and years?
You know what? I don't think it's been at least 5 years since I've worked there, 6 years. So I'm not sure how long it had been open, but it's still going. Mm-hmm. They're great. I mean, if I could, I would steal every one of them. You know what I mean? That's how passionate every one of those men are. And they've worked there for years, and they know exactly what they're talking about because they eat, sleep, and breathe guitars, and Gibsons particularly. It's outstanding. I learned so much about passion for this industry through those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's because they're kind of the unsung heroes. They don't get, you know, everybody kind of says so many good things about the custom shops of these big manufacturing companies, and that's what gets the press because those are the high dollar sales. But really, if you get a team like the Restoration Shop at Gibson.
Well, I've never heard of any other. I mean, fantastic. Martin does restoration, but it's just directly through Martin.
Right.
But it's kind of their custom guys that are doing it. And I think
absolutely.
The same thing with Fender.
Yeah.
But I've never heard of I'm trying to think of the days when I list Red Guitar Player, the different. I've never even heard of it in Guitar Player.
Sure.
So which is a shame because people should be aware of that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they're needing business or not.
Yeah, that's true. they might
be getting a phone call tomorrow telling me to, be quiet. I don't know.
Yeah. But what did.
I go on tangents.
No, you're fine.
So I lasted there for about a year, and this is why. So I was down in Nashville. It's located in Nashville, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And the year that I had started repairing guitars or was in Dan Erlewine's shop, we went to Asia Symposium, which is a luthier convention or conference happening on the East Coast. And I went there and I met a guy named Joe Glazer. And Joe Glazer is this amazing thinker. And he owns a huge repair shop. I say huge. I mean, it's anything bigger than three people in a repair shop's pretty big in our industry. And I think Joe has maybe eight guys working for him, all outstanding.
Wow.
Top-notch repairers. Joe is, he's a guy to be reckoned with. And I would go to his shop just to be on the fly on the wall, just to watch how these guys approached repair, just to pick their brains for 2 seconds or to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe's so smart. He would always just allow me to ask questions, and he would ask questions back. And a lot of our conversations kind of ended to, where is this industry going? And how can it be improved with moving forward?
Mm-hmm.
And so we always ended with this idea of CAD, of industrial design, of CNC machines. And this was 6 years ago, I guess. And so I would go home. We started during the morning, started working at like 6:30. I'd be done at 3. I used to teach art classes at night to keep myself busy. But then in between times, I would just think, like, how do I want my career to go? How do I want my life to move forward? Mm-hmm. And so a little shy of a year at Gibson, I turned in my resignation so that I could go back to school for industrial design. And so that's what I did. Unfortunately, at that time, there wasn't any way or anywhere for me to move within the company. And so I needed to just kind of make my own path. So I resigned from there. And then I moved back to Louisville, Kentucky, where I went to school and got my industrial design technical certificate, because a lot of my undergrad transferred. Mm-hmm. So I only had to go to school for, I think maybe 2 semesters, something like this. So that kind of brings me out to LA. So after I got done with school, I moved back to Athens for a little bit and bartended during the day. The slow crowd that wouldn't stress me out. I'd repair in Dan's shop in the morning, and then at night I would just try and figure out my next plan. I set up a little shop and repaired a few vintage dulcimers and things like that in the few months that I lived there, and got a job offer to come out to LA.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And then you were at Westwood Music for a while.
I was at Westwood Music. They're the company that brought me out here to kind of revamp and manage their repair shop. And that was a great challenge. That was kind of a different type of management, repair shop management, than I was doing in Kentucky. Kentucky, it was two different stores, and they were all kind of a younger crowd. Mm-hmm. Westwood Music was, you know, it's a more of a legacy store. So there are a lot more vintage instruments, which was very fun. Mm-hmm. I got to know the customer service team at Martin a lot. Mm-hmm. They're my friends. Every NAMM, I take them cookies and coffee. And, you know.
Now, let me ask you, looking at Westwood Music and the stuff that you would get, the work that you would get there, and then looking at what you saw, like, in Nashville, not just the Gibson place, which was obviously all Gibson, but that other place that you were the fly on the wall place, what was the difference? Would you see more in Nashville just straight guitars, or would you get other weird, you know, like you were talking like you worked on dulcimers. In Westwood Music, did you get more variety of instruments? Or
I would say Westwood Music, when I was there, was very acoustic heavy. Mm-hmm. I quickly became the person that would get all the Martin Neckery sets for about a year. Mm-hmm. You know, customer service just send them to me, and that was great, you know, and I kind of specialize in finish touch up, so any kind of finish repairs on vintage instruments I would, you know, do there. When I was in Nashville, and I think this has to do a lot with the music scene, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Glazier Shop deals a lot with professional musicians who always have to be kind of playing what's now. They're in the studio a lot. They're recording a lot. So when I was there, and I don't want to pigeonhole Glazier Shop at all, because they can handle
anything
with confidence. But there was a lot of electric guitars, right? Because mm-hmm. you have your studio musicians, you have, you know, the town bands that are in there. Westwood Music, not so much. They're a legacy shop.
Really? You didn't have as many? Because a lot of my friends used to go that were session guys used to go to Westwood.
Sure. There might be a lot of session guys. It was just mostly acoustic heavy.
Now, let me ask you this, though. At the Gibson Restoration Center, mm-hmm. what was the main thing you worked on? Was it arch tops or Les Pauls or what was
you
it?
You know what? It was a mix of everything. Yeah. And, you know, the customer mix was from people who, I mean, you get vintage stuff in that their dad bought it for them, you know, and this was back in the 50s, and now they've finally retired and have enough money to invest it in refurbishing their dad's guitar. And then you'd also, you know, get rock stars. So it was a wide variety.
So you would get a lot of, but
very much, you know, a lot of passionate people. There's a lot of passionate stories about emotional connections to instruments.
Now you had mentioned on your last, I think it was an Instagram, you were talking about restoring and finishes and binding and stuff. You were talking about acoustic guitar binding where they pull.
Yeah,
pull out.
The shrinking.
Where did you learn to match the color? Did you learn that from Gibson or from Martin?
Oh.
To like you were, like you, because you said you had a cut, like if the binding shrinks, you got to replace.
Sure.
And then you had to match the color because the binding had faded.
Sure.
Which I thought was kind of cool.
So that's something that I picked up throughout the years at Dan's shop. Now, Dan brings in a whole different level of what the hell happened to my guitar, right? he gets some gnarly guitars in, you know, and when he was younger in his career, earlier in his career, he was kind of finish heavy and detail heavy. And so when I came aboard, that was my background was art. So I really kind of latched onto that a lot. And so he taught me a lot about blending and repairs and detailing. He would give me kind of tips and clues as the time went on. Throughout my stint of repairs, I always was the person to want something to look just that much more.
Right, to get it.
Yeah, I can challenge myself. I'm going to blend this crack in or blend this repair in. And so when I was at Gibson, that was a big deal, right? And I learned more about color matching because I was drop filling a lot more. because it was just a lot more work, right? You don't look up. You just go. So I actually, with the color matching of binding, there have been two techniques that have been used that I know of, right? One was kind of overspraying lacquer using airbrush or taping off and using a can, and the other one was mixing a little bit of dye in with acetone or solvent and then wiping it on. And so those techniques have been used for years and years and years. And so it wasn't until, I guess a couple years ago, I forget what I was doing, but I ended up spraying on a thin layer of lacquer on cellophane. And the cellophane bubbled up and shrunk and got distorted, but I was left with a really thin layer of lacquer. And so then I started using decal lacquer paper, and I would spray on this tinted lacquer and cut it out in strips to match that binding. Mm-hmm. And so that's where that came from. It was kind of a collaboration of all these years, and then me finally saying, how the hell do I do this easier? I do it so much.
I remember on my Washburn, it was it had shrunk a little bit.
Yeah.
They fixed it, but it was I don't think they had to replace anything in there. They were able to get it to work. It had just pulled
heat
off.
Heat it up and push it back. You can do that sometimes.
Yeah.
I do have a video on YouTube with Stumac where I teach how to, spray the color on. The brilliance behind it is you can float it off and see if it matches,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that's the biggest pain in the ass. When you came to that, for years I used to use the stain and solvent, and I got pretty good at it, but eventually you'll see streak marks.
Right?
And, and then it's, your gig's up. And you're not fooling anyone,
No, that's true. Now, one of the things we talked about a little bit to set up for this show, and I think we should talk about a little bit because you're getting now into, we're now at the point where you, after Westwood Music, you set up your own company.
Yeah.
And one of the things you wanted to talk about, and I think we should, because I never really thought about this, but is communicating with a tech, what to ask,
sure.
and getting that communication so that the person that's working on your guitar knows exactly what you want. And so tell me a little bit of some of the, where that came about, where people don't know how to express what they want to the guitar. Give us some examples.
Sure. Almost every one of my customers comes in and right away tells me the horror stories that they've had with other shops, right? This seems to be a ongoing trend. I want to preface that it's not just the fault of the client, right? The owner of the guitar. I think a lot of times us as techs can say, oh, well, they called the headstock a hand thingy. Okay, so did you take the time to actually, help them through that conversation? So I think that it also, this communication relies on the tech as well. And on my Instagram Lives, I really express that customer service is the number one thing that our industry needs to really start paying attention to. And not just the, blowing smoke at someone, but to really care, because each and every owner of an instrument really puts a lot of heart and energy into something that might not look or feel special to somebody else, but to them, it's the world.
Yeah.
So great examples of these miscommunications is not knowing parts in the anatomy of a guitar, right? And the only way to know that I think would probably just be to Google it. just to know what the headstock is, what a tech is talking about when they're saying the word nut or saddle or bridge, really just the mechanics. I think after that, you know, it's kind of like car talk. You know, you're saying,
right.
Well, my pickup sounds a little, you know, and your could be different, could, you know, sound like a click to me. Mm-hmm, I don't know.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. It's the navigation that I find very important. And so when a customer comes into my shop and they've had these experiences where they feel belittled, they feel like somebody was being rude, they feel like they were being ignored. I do stand up for the tech because I am one of them, and I've had to work on my communication skills. A lot of people who are technical thinkers have a hard time, A, being interrupted with thought process, especially if you're always trying to solve problems. So I always tell people, don't take that personally, right? And then ask questions and ask for help and be honest. So say, what you're saying doesn't make sense. Could you please explain it another way?
Right.
And if the tech is being a total jerk and just doesn't want to do that, well, then they don't want your business, right? Then find someone else.
Also, too, you were brought up with a person like Dan.
Sure.
Who encouraged questions and would answer.
Sure.
So you're always asking questions.
Sure.
So to you, when somebody asks you a question, it's a natural thing because that's what you did.
Right.
But a lot of guys, I saw this with engineers trying to get my sound in the studio. I had to learn the talk so that I could tell them, you know, what my sound was. Because you're walking in with a session and everybody's there and they're trying to mic everybody. And they're just like, we got to roll tape because, you know, time is money.
Time is money, right.
And so if you can give them an idea what you're looking for, that makes their job all the easier because they're able to deliver.
Sure.
So I learned about EQ, this, you know, maybe use this, you know, I would say I usually use this mic and I EQ it like this, and they loved that. Because it made their job easy. They didn't have to think about it. They just did it.
Sure. And I think that's very important. You just brought up a great point to know what you want. There's been a lot of conversations that take a long time just to pull out, what are you looking for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a handful of people that lead with, I think my truss rod needs adjusted. Well, why do you think that? And it does. It takes a bit more patience to try and figure out, you know, because there's a lot of stuff online, right?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody could walk into a session and say, well, turn down the gain because this is, I don't know anything about recording, so this is going to sound fake, but you know what I mean?
Yeah,
just
well, no, I mean,
Google
I would,
it,
I did
a
session,
YouTube channel, right?
And I spent the time getting the amp to sound a certain way.
Sure.
Recorded it, and then I heard the mix, and it's like, what the hell?
What the hell
it totally
just happened?
Was different.
Sure.
So that's how I learned. And fortunately, a lot of the people I worked with, as I did sessions at an early age, because I was young, they were very open for me asking questions. So they showed me how to mic, what mics they use, and why.
And that's so important, is to, you know, kind of fill those voids.
And I know, some people were very threatened by questions, like because you were questioning them. It wasn't a challenge.
Authority.
It was, I want to learn.
Sure.
But a lot of them, I was very fortunate. A lot of them were teaching, so it was a natural thing for them. And it was very good because that's how I picked up a lot of stuff. And I think that's good that you have that background where you asked a lot of questions because you're not threatened by that. And that's cool. So when somebody comes into your shop, they can ask a bunch of questions and learn what, you know, then they have a better idea what they like and what they
absolutely
don't like.
Absolutely.
Know. Now, I had my friend Dave bring a guitar in to use as, we're just going to, as an example to Basicle, to kind of set up a scenario where, you know, you can see you in action and your advice, because this is an interesting guitar. Let Dave hand her the guitar. He has this, I'll let him tell me what the year and all of that of the Tele is.
Right.
And then we'll use this as an example of what he
what
wants to have
done,
what
no,
he
I'm
wants to do to it. And then you can give him the pros and cons.
Sure.
So, Dave, just explain a little bit what year that is and what it is.
It's a 1973 Telecaster Deluxe.
Okay. And it had been modded for a Floyd Rhodes, so it was routed out, as you can see.
There is, yeah.
On we're running right now on Instagram, on Chelsea's Instagram. So she's holding the guitar right now. So you can see there's a big gap in it.
Yeah, this was, and the gap was finished over. So this probably has an unoriginal layer of shellac on it.
So anyway, originally we had talked about this. He was thinking about selling this, and one of our other friends like, no, it's really rare. It's like, you got to keep it. So he was asking, and I think if I'm correct, let's set it up to restore that to its original. Now, the problem with this guitar is the routing in it, because it has that Strat Floyd Rose setup. So a lot of the wood's missing in the around the bridge area. And sure. she's holding it, and on the Instagram, you can see the back, and she's sewing it. And then plus also on the neck,
locking nut.
They put the locking nut on there. So pros and cons of this wood. It looks like it's ash. Filling that in with wood, would that work, or would that affect the sound? Would it, you know?
Well, you know, the idea of tone and sound, we could a dog could chase its tail just as fast, you know. I think Mr. Taylor proved very swiftly that tone is, you know, is in the pickups. That being said, there's nothing like picking up an electric guitar that you can really feel the vibrations and the sustain.
Right.
So you're asking me, right? And so my question, because I'm question heavy, would be, what are you trying to attain by restoring this to be as much original as possible?
Playability.
Okay.
And resellability.
Resellability. Okay, so right away, having it resold, and I don't really do appraisals, I don't talk much about money except for this is, the finish has been modified, right? That's a huge thing with resale value.
Mm-hmm.
And then this big chunk is missing, right? You're not going to ever blend that in. I've plugged many a wrong route outs, right? And you can spend hours painting the grain, which I've done, and you're just never going to blend it in.
But he could, since it's already, the finish is not original, he could make it a solid color and
he
cover
could make it. You could make it a solid color. That's another thing.
But putting the wood in
burst
there.
It, you know.
But putting the wood inside there and making that solid again.
Sure.
Will that give it the sustain that it have, or does it? Is it a kind of a compromise?
This right now it doesn't have much, you know, because there's a hole going straight through it. So yeah, it would, you know, give it a little bit more sustain. I'd use natural glue. So
because some people claim that the body, like especially some of the telly, you know, the grain, the fact that you're putting another piece of wood in there and the grain isn't consistent, will it affect the sound?
Sure. And that's one of those questions that I don't think so, because the there's pickups involved, right?
Right.
And that's just where I stand with electrics. When it comes to the actual physics of it and the sound transfer, you're absolutely right. It will affect it.
Now, let me ask you this. Is there something that you could put in there that's wood or similar to wood that's more mass that would give him more weight in there that would give him more sustain?
I don't know if he'd want more weight. It's about 7 pounds, but
no, but I mean,
I know what you mean.
Yeah, so that it actually sort of sustain.
I don't know.
Have you used anything else besides just straight wood?
No, a lot of times when people, the same kind of question, they'll bring stuff like this in. I mean, it's not as neat, to be quite honest. It usually looks pretty hacky. But I'll just grain match it and then tone the wood.
Like, for example, with that, that's an ash body.
Yeah.
If you put a slab of maple in there, would that be better? Would that be worse? You see what I'm saying?
Then you're talking degrees. Then it's measurable by, I mean, you'd need some...
And since you would refinish it anyway...
Some tools.
To hide the...
Sure, I would still probably use ash.
You would just go ahead and keep it all ash?
Just a little harder, you know what I mean? Maple's a little lighter. I wouldn't want it to shrink anymore.
Okay.
You know, not that I'm trying to divide the species of wood or anything, but
no.
That would be my one reasoning behind it mm-hmm. is the shrinking. And
now let me ask you, what would you do about the nut?
This, I mean, you know what? Actually, repair like this, I've done it before. It blends in a little bit better because you're just replacing that one back strip behind the original nut. So it's not too bad.
It's not too bad.
Yeah, you could just plug these up pretty easily. I mean, the back, you probably wouldn't be able to blend it in. You know, that's pretty gnarly, but...
Yeah, the holes where the bolt is.
You could plug them up, you know, and make it light, you know, the wood light.
And just do a touch-up finish there?
Sure.
That would be...
Sure. I mean, if, you know, if there was finish, you with, like, let's say Gibson broken headstock, you kind of burst around it if you, you know, wanted to... Things like
so
that.
So that's not a big deal.
It's maple. It's yeah. I mean, that's the thing with things that repairs like this will always have scars. When people buy something like this and they want to make it like it's never happened, I almost want to tell them this is not the guitar to do that with. Not that you can't modify and make it. It's not that you can't remojoify it, right? Mm-hmm. You can absolutely make it your guitar, but to think that you're going to repair something and hide those scars is very unattainable. And a lot of, I think a lot of miscommunication in repair shops is caused by that. People think that they're going to get back a brand new guitar, and when in case, it's not going to be the same. It's still a repair. There's still... those battle wounds, you know?
Yeah. But what you're talking about is it would look pretty good. I mean, what you're saying
sure.
is it would look pretty close to original. I mean, it would be...
Sure.
It is an original. It's already been destroyed in terms of that pristine collectible
value.
Of value.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, actually, you can... I mean, it's like you could...
serial numbers and stamps. People would love that.
Like, refinishing it would be... You know, you can do anything because it doesn't matter. That's not the original finish.
I'm thinking sparkles.
he likes metal flake. He's a
yeah,
big metal
there
flake.
You go.
So,
big
now,
rainbow flake.
I want to go into the other guitars, but I want to ask you a question. For example, Strats and Les Pauls, and those are most common among the players. We were talking, Dave and I were talking the other day about that, the problem with Les Pauls and the G string.
Sure.
How do you solve that?
Oh, I'm going to try not to get in trouble.
Okay.
By answering this question. So it's really, we're discussing, without naming companies, we're discussing long scale and short scale when it comes to standard guitar size. And I was actually having a great conversation earlier today about this. Short scale is always going to be a little wonky, right? It's always going to pull sharp and then flat, depending on what fret you intonate at. That's the mathematics of it. Long scale is going to be more accurate because mathematics spread is more true. That also... lends to the sound, though, of the short scale companies. You know, they.
Who's a short scale company?
You know, Gibson short scale.
Oh, that's considered short scale.
Yeah, I think that I don't know. Is PRS short scale?
I don't know.
There's a couple of other companies, but the
who's long scale?
Big one that would be Fender.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, they're just called. It just referred to as short and long scale.
Now, I always heard
much of a difference, but
I always heard that part of the problem was the angle, and if you set the nut right and flare it out, you can stop the binding, and you can also it would be more. The problem we're talking about, in case you're not familiar with it out there, is that the G string is the hardest to intonate, and a lot of times you have to, you got to play with it a little bit and sometimes temper the tuning.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, for example, if your open string, your open guitar chord is, you know, like a first fret is perfect and you go up to, like, the fifth or seventh fret, it will go out.
Right.
So you have to kind of temper it. And it's common on my Les Paul. That's a common thing.
Sure.
But I'm so used to doing it. And then if I'm doing a session and I'm playing a lead, I'll adjust it a certain way and then I'll go the other way for chords. So that's what we're talking about. Now, I've heard that some people said you can, it's the nut can be set up to make it better. And you know, and then of course there's the option like the Buzzy Featon system.
I was going to say like the stepped nuts, you know, the Buzz Featon nuts and things like that help. If you open up the channel and back, it does help with binding. I always kind of, that's the first thing.
So you flare it out a little.
I always flare it out just a tiny bit, not overly, but when I intonate a string, make a nut, make a saddle, I want that string to have two contact points. I don't want it to be on sitting on a ledge, because that gives you untrue reading. It can give you back buzz. It can do all kinds of binding, things like this. And I just, it's not worth it. So I do, when I make nuts, I just flare out that back end. It helps, like you said, with the binding. Another thing you can try if you're having these issues, especially if a string is always pulling flat, check the tuning machines. Sometimes those gears get old and crotchety. But yeah, with the Gibsons, I always suggest with short scale that wherever the most part of the neck you're playing at, so let's say that you're playing at the first seven frets, you don't get much more, right? The cowboy chords. I'd intonate up there. So if you're playing one through seven, I'd intonate at the fifth so that that fret is dead on and everything else is just slightly off from there, right? Now, if you're going to play up at the 12th, you're going to be even more off. So you really got to know what you're going to play and how to play it.
But right.
I do. I suggest kind of instead of, you know, intonating at that octave, cheating a little. Yeah.
Okay. Now, it's interesting. And the other thing I wanted to ask you was, have you played around with the, I was telling on some of the other guitars that I've worked on, I've put Duraline nuts that are self-lubricating. How do you like those?
I think I've maybe cut one in my life. Yeah.
Because I have Bigsby's on my guitar.
Sure. Yeah, no, I totally get it. You know, so some people are trying to get back into the nylon, the N6 or whatever, the 7. I put more of those on. It's okay, yeah. You know. I don't have a problem with them.
I can't stress the importance of how your tech sets that nut so that it doesn't bind, that it, you know.
Sure.
If that's done right, a lot of your problems with your guitar are gone.
That's so true.
It really is important, and that's one of the things you should, if you're going to do a redo of a guitar, you know, if you're going to do a major restoration or fix the guitar, have them, if you need to, redo the nut. I mean, if it's necessary, because if it's not done right, it's going to just be a headache. And even the one I had on my original Les Paul that's original, it was binding all the time, and I ended up, in those days we used to take number two pencils and put the graphite in.
People still do that.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah,
it works,
that's why. Yeah.
So, but I mean, you know, if it's done right, like you said, like you'd flare it out and stuff, and I've talked to other techs about that. There's an art to that, to do it right, and if it's done that, it makes it so much less headache.
Absolutely.
Now, real quick, we're almost out of time.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the two guitars that you brought in.
Ooh, okay.
Real quick, and then I want to talk a little bit about your website.
Okay.
And your YouTube channel.
So I brought in the two guitars that have changed my career. This is the first one. If you're watching on Instagram Live, you might have seen this guitar. It is the first guitar that I was ever published with in 2005 in Guitar Player magazine on the issue with the Mod Squad. And the Mod Squad was Dan Erlewine and his team of minions. there was I think five of us that were working in his shop. And we kind of the articles were a series, I think, that spanned for 3 years of us teaching people how to do stuff at home. And this was the flagship article where I painted on my own design. And this was kind of the first design after that stinger, of course, that original broken head sock that I did. And it just kind of opened up my eyes to the possibilities of aesthetics and guitars.
Now, we're almost out of time. Yeah. So real quick, this Gibson, and then I want to get all the information.
An LG0. I got this for $200 at Guitar Emporium in Louisville, Kentucky. And it was unplayable. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to try to be perfect and restore this. I'm going to see if I can't rebuild it for it to play the best it can play and sound the best it can sound. And I accomplished that, and I fell in love with the guitar. And that's what bred the idea of CC Recycled Guitars, which mm-hmm. is a project that I do, taking the good parts of bad instruments to make great-sounding guitars.
Okay. Well, I told you this would go by fast. We're already out of time.
Sure.
I just want to mention your website, guitarsandcaffeine.com, mm-hmm. and you can connect with her if you want to. Phone number to get to call you?
Yeah, 310-881-9988. Do not text that number. It is a landline.
There you go. And she does all sorts of repairs and adjustments, so you can there's a lot more. We just touched the surface of what she really does. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I think it's great what you're doing. Next time we it just means you have to come back because we haven't covered it.
Jeff, you're awesome, anytime.
I really want to talk about next time about the CC Recycled guitars. I think that's an important thing. Dave, thanks for bringing down the telly.
Yeah.
And Suni, thanks for hanging with us, too. Yeah.
Thank you.
Everybody, check this out, guitarsandcaffeine.com. And what's your YouTube channel?
You know what? It's I think it's Guitars and Caffeine. But most of my videos right now are through Stu Mac.
Stu Mac?
Yeah. So look up Stuart McDonald's YouTube channel.
And, okay. Because she has all sorts of stuff on how to do your own adjustments, what to look for. I mean, it's really
informative. Oh, yeah. I do a lot on Instagram. So I'll do a lot of live stuff on Instagram.
Okay. Anyway, thank you so much. It's really good to have
you
on
so
the
much.
Show, and we'll definitely have you back. Dave, thank you. Suni, thank you. Everybody, have a great week. We'll see you next week.